Okay, our final argument this morning is in Hodges versus Life Insurance Company. The number is 18-1279. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. I'm Jack Englert, Jr. I represent the appellate Life Insurance Company of North America, to which I will refer as LINA. Under this court's precedent, the threshold issue of the applicable standard of review is not a close question. This court has repeatedly addressed this issue and has been very clear on its interpretation of the sort of language that is necessary to trigger the application of the arbitrary and capricious standard of review. And in this case, to begin with, there is an express grant of discretionary authority in the amendatory rider of the policy about ERISA, where the language specifically states that the plan administrator, which is the employer and the plan sponsor here, Endo Pharmaceuticals, appointed the insurance company, LINA, to decide claims. That is an express grant of discretionary authority that doesn't even require the analysis that this court has engaged in what's been described as its liberal approach to the interpretation of this sort of language.
Wouldn't that make any plan administrator that is authorized to decide claims entitled to the arbitrary and capricious standard of review?
No. Because I have seen plans where there is not this sort of active language identifying the discretion.
Well, but the language you just quoted was simply that they get to decide. You didn't use the word discretion.
The word discretion is not used. You're correct, Your Honor. But the court does not require that. The court requires some sort of language that indicates that the claim administrator is deciding or determining these claims. And I certainly have seen many plans that don't have that active voice language describing the role of the claim administrator.
Well, let me just, I'm just curious where you would draw the line in terms of how these policies get written. What language would delegate authority to decide whether the benefits should be awarded but not delegate discretion?
Well, under this court's precedent, if the plan language actively states something along the lines of the claim administrator will determine, will decide, the evidence must be satisfactory to, all of that is the sort of language that this court has found to be satisfactory. Now, if the plan doesn't have that statement that the claim administrator will determine, will decide, that the evidence must be satisfactory to the claim administrator under this court's precedent, then the absence of that language would result in the application.
So I just want to make sure I understand your position. If the policy says that the plan administrator is to decide or determine benefits, that's it.
That's correct.
That's a per se rule.
That's correct, and that's the approach this court has taken in McGraw and Eugene S. and the other cases that we've cited in the brief.
The district court calls that a truism, and it is a little different than the language proof satisfactory to the administrator. That's more clear to me that that's discretionary. I guess the reason the district court says it's a truism is obviously the administrator is going to determine whether or not benefits are payable. That's going to happen every single time. So like Judge Matheson says, if this is good enough, then there's no such thing as de novo. It's going to be abuse of discretion every time the administrator is charged with deciding, which is going to be every time.
Well, I respectfully disagree with that for the following reasons, Your Honor. And of course, other plans aren't in front of the court. And so, you know, my response to the court in part is based upon my experience, which is not evidence. But there are plenty of plans where the description of the claim review process is put in the passive voice. And it doesn't have the sort of active language that this court has required. And the district court's discussion of the truism is an analysis that other circuits have adopted in discussing the appropriate language to trigger the deferential standard review. But those circuits are going down a road that this court has not. This court's precedent has taken the approach that we've discussed in the brief, that if you have this language in the active voice talking about the claim administrator determining or deciding, that's adequate. And that's why this court itself has described its position as a relatively liberal approach.
Does it make a difference under the interpretive canon, I suppose, of reading the policy as a whole, that in this particular policy, there is reference in one of the other provisions to sole discretion. So the parties understood what it meant to say more explicitly what discretion, by using the word itself, should be in the policy. Why shouldn't we take that into account? We don't have any language that says you can decide benefits in your discretion or your sole discretion. We just have decide, whereas this other provision refers to sole discretion.
As I've said, this court has not required the use of the word discretion.
I don't think that's responsive. I'm asking, if you read the policy as a whole, why doesn't that point against a reservation of discretion?
Could the policy have been written differently? Yes. Did the policy use the word discretion in that one place that the court has noted? Of course. But that standing alone is not adequate under the precedent of this court and the Supreme Court, for that matter, to overcome the language that this court has repeatedly held as adequate. This court has cited language identical to the language in this policy, using the word determined as adequate or sufficient to trigger discretionary authority, and has not required the use of the word discretion or discretionary authority.
And when you say the Supreme Court, you're referring to Firestone.
Firestone and other cases that have talked about the importance of the deferential standard of review. And of course, Firestone is the starting point for all the case law. This court's original decisions on which we rely about the sort of language that is necessary interpret Firestone and arrive at their conclusion based upon Firestone. And there's nothing in Firestone that would require an express use of the word discretion. And that's certainly the conclusion that this court has taken in McGraw and Nance and the various other cases that we've cited.
Could I just ask you, if the standard of review were de novo, I know you would say it's not, but if it were, is Mr. Hodges entitled to Class 2 status at this point?
No, and I'm glad you asked that because, of course, in our briefs...
Well, then I'm sorry to interrupt, but maybe I'll throw one more in and then you can respond to the whole thing, which is, if that's the case, do we even need to decide the standard of review question? If you win under either standard of review, why are we even talking about the standard of review?
You're right on both counts, Your Honor. Of course, in ERISA cases... the threshold issue is the standard review, and I suppose like an old fire horse, the bell goes off and I charge out of the firehouse, and I'm talking about the standard review. And it is obviously an important issue. And the focus of our briefs was on the analysis of the facts under the deferential standard review. But I believe there's a footnote in there, and somewhere I know we said that it wouldn't make a difference under the de novo review. And Your Honor is correct. If this court, in its review of this case, finds that the standard review doesn't matter in terms of the outcome, that would be the end of it. If you agree that the determination was correct, if you agree that the determination was correct. And I suppose if you, and I'm spinning around in my mind here a little. I mean, obviously, if you agree with me that the classification is correct, the standard review doesn't matter. And I suppose
I want to make clear that's an if at the moment.
Oh, I understand.
Right.
Oh, believe me, I understand. After all, I'm the appellant here.
Right.
You know, I've got the steeper hill to climb. There's no question about that. But I suppose that the court could agree with the district court that the de novo standard applied and then disagree with the district court in terms of its analysis. And for all of the reasons argued in our brief, I believe that that should be the result under the de novo standard. I mean, when you look at all of this evidence that was presented, the evidence shows that the determination was correct. You know, the plan provides that the covered earnings will be based on information as reported by the employer, and the employer has an obligation to provide information, and it did provide this information. And although Hodges has cited various documents as supporting his position that he's a salesperson, none of that says he's a salesman. I mean, Hodges himself, when he was talking to Lina in an early conversation, admitted that he was a technician. Technicians can get bonuses. They can do a good job. There can be incentive compensation for a technician, but that doesn't equate with them being a salesman. And he quite simply was not a salesman. His job description repeatedly goes into all this detail about what's involved with the job and the training and the responsibilities, and none of it has to do with sales.
But you would agree, wouldn't you, that the policy doesn't define the term sales personnel?
I do. I agree with that.
Does anybody really define it other than just to say he is or he isn't? Did Lina, or, am I saying it right? Lina
is the way the acronym is pronounced, yes.
Okay. Did Lina ever define it, or did Endo define it, or it's just a matter of saying either he is or he isn't?
Well, I guess it's more of the latter. I mean, you know, Endo is the employer, and Endo starts the process by providing the eligibility feed in which it identifies, among other things, the class of the employee. And then, as the court knows from the briefs, there were repeated communications and Endo consistently saying he's not a sales employee.
Well, counsel, can I just get you to stop there? Can you give us a definition of sales personnel? What is your definition?
Well, my definition would be someone whose primary duties are selling a product, marketing a product. I suppose with Endo Pharmaceuticals, it would be somebody going out and his primary job or her primary job would be to go to healthcare providers or hospitals and selling whatever these services are, these cryotherapy services, and marketing so that the healthcare provider says, all right, we want to use your services. And then at that point, Mr. Hodges, as a technician, would show up to continue the process, to show how the process is done.
Well, that's is it different. Because the people are already there to get the service? Is that what you're saying?
My understanding...
The selling has already occurred by the time the person gets to the technician?
That's my understanding, yes, that... You know, that obviously there's references that a technician like Mr. Hodges could come up with other prospects for sales to follow up with. He could try to do other procedures. But the documentation shows that the bonuses that came Mr. Hodges' way were focused on him doing extra procedures.
You mean performing additional work? Is that what
additional work, yes. Additional work. Not selling per se.
Well, your initial answer really put emphasis on the word primary. You said that like three times, primary. Are you suggesting here that this wasn't his primary purpose and maybe he did do some selling? Is it kind of a percentage problem or he did no selling?
Well, we get back to the definition, I guess, at that point. I mean, I...
Well, and that's why I'm asking you.
Well, no, yeah. I'm not quibbling or criticizing your question by any means. I guess my use of the word primary is unfortunate. I mean, you know, in the brief we went through the job description, and there are, you know, 20 or more descriptions of what he does, none of which involve sales. There are four parts of it that deal with education and training, none of which deal with sales. And then there are these general purposes that talk about what he does, and none of them do involve sales. There are references to business development. I don't think generic references to business development ring the bell of sales. And so my use of primary is not a good use. I don't believe he was a salesperson. Endo didn't think he was a salesperson. And I think if you ask the average plan participant, a reasonable average plan participant, is a technician such as Mr. Hodge a salesperson, their understanding would be no. And therefore, Lina's determination was correct under the de novo standard or reasonable under the deferential standard. Under either standard, I submit that this court should uphold its determination. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, David Lichtenstein appearing for the appellee, Tony Hodges, or Anthony Lou Hodges. With me at the table is my co-counsel, Matt Molinaro. I want to address that last point first of what is a salesman, and more importantly, how did the company classify or fail to classify Mr. Hodges as a salesman? Lina relies greatly on the eligibility feed. As the district court pointed out, we have no idea when the eligibility feed was created, whether it was in response to Mr. Hodges' claim or whether it preexisted. There is nothing in the record that indicates that the company ever classified anyone as sales personnel. And if the company has the ability to decline and deny benefits to an employee, simply by not classifying an employee or any employee as sales personnel, then they effectively have the ability to rewrite the policy and write the Class 2 benefit out of the policy. That can't be right. That can't be common sense. If we are in the de novo world, then, of course, we have to look at Mr. Hodges' reasonable expectation when he reads this policy. It's very interesting that the Class 2 benefit, the covered earnings, include bonuses. They include the target incentive compensation plan that he operated under, that he actually received bonuses under, but it excludes commissions. So that's what we usually think of when we think of sales personnel. Obviously, the policy had something else in mind when it references sales personnel. We don't know what, because it's never defined in the policy. Mr. Hodges indeed admitted, it's undisputed, that he was a technician and that he did some of the production work involved in Endo's operations. But Lina knew that that wasn't the end of the story, because they came back after they were advised by Endo that he was, in fact, a technician, and they said, well, does he sell? Is he a salesman?
Could I ask you a question about this last point you've been making? The policy defines the Class 2 employees as all active full-time employees of the employer classified as sales personnel. Well, if Endo classified Mr. Hodges as a cryotherapy technician, then isn't that the classification? That doesn't sound like a sales personnel. That was his classification. And the policy says classified as sales personnel.
Well, two answers to that. One, first of all, the company never made any classifications, at least the record doesn't disclose any classifications.
That's his job. He's a cryotherapy technician. Why isn't that? That seems like a classification. I mean, when you're setting up a business and you say, okay, you're in HR and you're over here in purchasing or whatever, you're classifying. And that seems like a classification.
Well, I guess that goes into my second answer, which, as the district court pointed out, these are not mutually exclusive. And I think Judge Ide makes a good point, which is what percentage of your duties go to sales or go to production? There's no bright line there, and the company really has the burden of defining and establishing where that line is. Mr. Hodges earned on the order of 25 to 30% of his compensation from the extra work that he got from selling these services, from going to physicians' offices, from being encouraged by management to meet physicians every time they visited a physician's office. But
does the record show that he actually sold anything?
Yes, there is a sample.
What does a sale look like as made by a cryotherapy technician?
Well, unfortunately, we've put the wrong label on what he gets paid for. But he does. There's a pay stub in the record that shows a bonus, and he would get these bonuses for going in, doing extra cases that he had generated through his own efforts. So it's kind of a syllogism. If you sell a physician on a case and then you perform the case, you get paid. So, yeah, there's an extra step in there, but it's, as we used to say in tax class, it's a step transaction.
So is it a sale of services?
Yes, not goods, but services. And I think we've cited several different dictionary definitions that include services in things that you can sell. I hope I've answered your question.
Can I just shift gears for a second? You argue, well, let me back up. The district court devoted a lot of its opinions in both instances to the process problems that were involved here. Mm-hmm. And you seem to argue that we could decide, this court could, that your client is a Class 2 employee based on procedural defects alone. Am I right so far in understanding your argument?
The court could, but it doesn't have to.
No, I understand. But what's your best case for us on that? Could you give us an example where a court has done that in a situation that's like this one?
I'm trying to make sure I understand the question.
I just want an on-point case. If we're going to go with your argument, we need to cite something for it.
Right.
What would we say?
I don't know that a single case gets you there, but certainly once we get the standard of review established, and I think we can do that both through the fact that Wynette breached its fiduciary duty and did not give him a full and fair review, plus the textual argument, and that gets us to de novo review. At that point, it's a matter of reasonable expectations. So there's nothing in the record that indicates Mr. Hodges was ever told that he would be classified as either kind of employee.
Can I just clarify? Again, on this procedural defect, I don't know, does the standard of review even matter? I mean, if the process used, if the argument was failure to do a full and fair review, failure to ask about this, failure to investigate that, that really doesn't have anything to do with the review of the merits at that point. So isn't it just a matter of if it was so deficient, then, again, I'm understanding you to suggest that's one possible ground for us to say he's a Class 2. I don't want to belabor the point because I...
No. One case I would certainly look to is the Gaither case, which is cited in our brief at page 23, that Lina cannot shut its eyes to the evidence that Mr. Hodges provided as to his sales duties and the results of those duties, the various sales tasks that were assigned to these technicians and salespeople to basically go out and emphasize growing the business, growing the company's presence in physicians' offices and in operating rooms. I do keep coming back to reasonable expectations because I think that's so important. When you look at the policy, again, if you're making a lot of your income is coming from the cases you do through your promotional efforts, and you're looking at a policy that says you get class two employees covered earnings include these bonuses and this target incentive compensation plan, one of three of which actually Mr. Hodges submitted to Lina. Certainly, his expectation had to be that he was going to get a disability benefit that's based on the same kind of compensation arrangement that he got when he was working.
If Endo does close its eyes to it, then what? Then it's an arbitrary and capricious decision?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the entire question.
All right, you started off by talking about if Endo were to close its eyes to the employee's evidence, then what? Then it's arbitrary and capricious decision? We would have sufficient reason to rule
sure.
in your favor on that ground.
It's inherently arbitrary, and it's Lina that purports to be making the decision, but it's inherently arbitrary if you don't give a full and fair review, if you're not looking at the claimant's evidence, and if your thumb is on the scale when you defer to Endo without searching beyond the superficial evidence they're giving you, but you're not giving any attention to Mr. Hodges' own evidence.
Well, I'm still trying to separate out your procedure argument on the one hand and your merits argument on the other. And even under an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, the merits review would be based on whether there was substantial evidence. Isn't that the correct yardstick?
Well, under the arbitrary and capricious standard, that's correct.
All right. Well, that was my question.
Right.
Okay. Maybe we ought to let you talk a little bit more about the standard of review, because opposing counsel points out that this circuit's a little more generous about arbitrary and capricious standard of review than maybe some of the other circuits. So it's your job to convince us that our cases are not inconsistent with your position.
Right. And, counsel keeps referring to precedent. I could only find one case that counsel cited that is even a close case, and that was the one case that, this is the McGraw case, that does talk about a determination by Prudential as to a very specific point in that policy. I think that can be distinguished on several bases. First of all, it's dicta because the court did eventually find for the claimant in that case anyway. There's very little reasoning as to why that language would satisfy the standard for arbitrary and capricious. And again, that actually runs right up against Firestone because, as the court pointed out at the very beginning of counsel's argument, that would give essentially give the insurer a free pass on every case and make every case arbitrary and capricious. There's the structural part of our policy that's so different from the one at issue in McGraw. Counsel referred to the amendatory rider, and that is the only place in the policy where this language about Lina will decide the claim. If you look at the entirety of the amendatory rider, it's really about timing. It's about strictly procedural matters, and rather than stating up front in a way the insured can understand and the beneficiary can understand that they have discretionary authority in all aspects of their decision.
What does it mean to have non-discretionary authority? This is a practical matter. I mean, the plan administrator has this claim presented to it. It's supposed to say yes or no. How is that going to be? How would you distinguish between it being a discretionary decision versus a non-discretionary one if they have to decide it? Well, they're told they have to decide. What makes that non-discretionary?
Well, because it's subject to judicial review on a de novo basis. A fiduciary is not just a fiduciary because the policy says it is. It's also a party that exercises its discretion, whether it does so rightly or wrongly.
That's a little too quick. I didn't catch up with you there, but it seems to me that what you just told me is, well, it's non-discretionary because it's subject to de novo review. But isn't that really what we're trying to decide here? Is it non-discretionary? I mean, that's what we're asking to decide, whether it is de novo review or arbitrary and capricious. And so I'm still trying to understand what, if they can decide something, what makes it, you say that's non-discretionary. He says it's discretionary. Why is it non-discretionary?
Well,
and it can't be just because it's de novo review. That begs the question. I mean, that's the answer we're trying to get.
Well, I think maybe Gilbertson answers that question, because if the claim administrator or plan administrator has not applied his expertise, its decision is not entitled to any deference. So here, Lina has not, it's entirely deferred to Endo. It hasn't made any decision on its own, and it's deferred to this, frankly.
Yeah, but wait a minute. The problem, though, is it's not what they did here so much. It's what the policy says, right? I mean, maybe they did defer to Endo. Let's assume that Endo said, he was a sales personnel line. He says, good enough for us, okay? Mm. But the question on whether they have discretionary authority, that has to be tied to the policy, right? Isn't that an interpretation of the text of the policy?
Well, the policy only gives them authority, not discretionary authority.
And that's true because?
Well, because the policy says so.
Okay. Because it doesn't say discretionary?
Right. It just says authority.
Counsel, can I just ask? I'm sorry. Follow up? I thought your argument was that in McGraw, there was the language said determine according to these criteria, which suggested discretion, whereas you don't have that language. Is that not your argument?
Well, that's right. I think the discretion. And again, I know you're going to say this is backward, but if they exercise discretion, they are entitled to the arbitrary and capricious standard if the policy clearly says that, but it doesn't. So they've exercised discretion, but they haven't done it in any meaningful way. They haven't used their expertise.
Okay. Thank you.
By the way, after a long morning, it's entirely possible I had it backwards, but I'll study it and let you know. Appreciate your argument. Appreciate both of your arguments. The case will be submitted, and counsel are excused.